So thank you for coming here. And these kind of talks were kind of envisaged as being kind of complementary, that Andrew would talk about fiscal policy and I'd talk about monetary policy. And that's kind of true, but we're also going to be complementary in different ways. So Andrew's got a lot of anecdotes about, you know, talking with Kevin and Ken. I unfortunately don't have any of those. I am, after all, a boring central banker. But there are other areas. So, you know, when I was thinking about how are we going to talk about what have we learned since the crisis, you could do as Andrew did and kind of look through what worked during the crisis. And certainly, as he's argued, we learned that fiscal stimulus can work. It's something that perhaps we'd forgotten. We thought that fiscal stimulus was kind of very slow. But, you know, when the chips are down, you can move very quickly. With monetary policy, we've learned, for example, that we've got more than just the interest rate lever. We didn't necessarily learn that in Australia, but it's certainly one of the learnings. We could also look at mistakes that were made. The fact that borrowing 105% of the value of your house was ever thought to be a wise thing to do is surprising to me. But I think the fact that it's surprising to all of us now shows we've learned something. But what I'm going to do actually is I'm going to take a different approach. I'm going to focus not on the GFC itself, but on today. And what I want to do is I want to look at how we understand things differently now compared to before the crisis. I want to do this because I think the best way to judge what you've learnt is how you've changed as a result. So if your behaviour doesn't change, have you really learnt anything? So I want to talk about how we conduct research differently and what this implies for how we think about the economy. So I won't be talking about crisis management or crisis prevention or crisis cleanup. If you want to read about that, well, you've just had a very good discussion from Andrew, but you can read, for example, The Courage to Act by Ben Bernanke, or there was a speech Guy Debelle gave last year where he talked about kind of what went on in Australia. So this is very much about the ongoing changes from the GFC rather than cutting interest rates by 400 plus basis points in the crisis. So how do we think about things differently now? So I think a good way to do this is just look at how our behaviour has changed. I'm a researcher, so as a researcher, the way our behaviour changes is what are we researching? Because the questions we choose to spend our time researching and kind of the judgments we make about what's interesting really is a reflection of what we think is important and what we don't know. And in that sense, it's a sign of, by implication, what we do know and what we've learned. So to get a sense of this, I read over, well, not all of them, but more than 200 discussion papers that we've put out between 2000 and today. And I focus on the RBA research because it's what I know, but also because this is kind of on monetary policy and what we were thinking at the central bank. It kind of gives an idea of what were the intellectual currents at the Reserve Bank. And I do this despite the fact that if you read very closely on the cover of every research discussion paper, it says views expressed in this paper are those of the authors and not necessarily those of the Reserve Bank. So this is not to say that any of the answers there were necessarily the views of the Reserve Bank, but surely the questions we were asking reflects what's going on inside. So how do we do that? What I did is I put all those words into a great big copper pot still, and I distilled them down into kind of this word cloud. And so what you can see is two halves. The top half is the words that we were using in RDPs written between 2000 and the financial crisis. The bottom half is the words that we were using in post-GFC research. So if we look in on the top half, you can see that we were using the term monetary policy a lot. You also see we're talking about exchange rates, assets, and components. Since the financial crisis, very big word there, shock, that perhaps is not surprising. You'll also see financial crisis and global financial crisis. That's not too surprising, but you'll also see some words that I'm going to come back to and talk about more, which is things like consumer, system, structure, and resource up there, which is actually resources. These kind of can give you some high-level feeling for what's going on, but to kind of give you a bit more context, what I've done here is put together all the topics in the research discussion papers over that approximately 20-year period, and I've divided them into half, those pre-GFC and those post-GFC. And I've cut out a bit in the middle because it's never quite clear exactly what's going on kind of in the transition period. And I've ranked them. So the ones on the left are the ones where the proportion of research has declined, and the ones on the right are where the proportion has increased. And so what you can see is that research on monetary policy and inflation and labour markets has declined somewhat, while unsurprisingly research on financial markets and banking and payment systems has increased. Now this is kind of reflected in the word cloud, but this hopefully gives you a little more context. And I'm going to kind of focus on three of those to kind of give you some more insight into what's going on. I'm going to talk about the monetary policy one, I'm going to talk about the open economy, and I'm going to talk about financial markets and banking. So let's talk about monetary policy. So that is typically an investigation of how do you conduct monetary policy in particular circumstances. It's generally we build a model of the economy, we run various experiments on how monetary policy should operate, and to give you some better sense, here are some representative titles. Inflation targeting and exchange rate fluctuations in Australia. The real-time forecasting performance of Phillips curves. Monetary policy, asset price bubbles and the zero lower bound. You might be interested to know that was a pre-GFC paper. So we were actually thinking about related issues before the financial crisis. So these are papers that have helped us refine what's the inflation targeting framework. You know, how do we understand the economy? How do we operate monetary policy? Because really we were still in the early-ish years of the inflation targeting framework. So we're still trying to work out exactly how do you run this thing. And the words like component from the cloud are that we're also asking questions like kind of which components of inflation are better measures. You know that we care about underlying inflation, but the reason we care about that is a bunch of research we did trying to work out, you know, do oil prices and fruit and vegetable prices give us much indication of what's going on in the future versus other components like rental costs or housing costs. So this is kind of what we were doing pre-GFC. And the fact that the quantity of such papers has declined, you might think, well, that's surprising. What's going on there? But I say this is a sign of learning. Basically, as we answered questions, and those questions were come up, those answers we came up with were good answers, there are less questions to be asked. So the fact that there's declining research on monetary policy, I'll argue, is actually a sign that the research and the experience we developed in those areas has stood the test of time. So despite the experience of the financial crisis, what we've found is that, you know, circumstances haven't changed that much that we need to actually change the framework, that there was a big weakness exposed in the monetary policy framework. And indeed, we held a conference on this last year where we invited a bunch of experts around the world and from Australia to have a discussion about it. And the broad conclusion was inflation targeting actually worked pretty well, not just over the past 10 years or through the financial crisis, but over the past 25 years. Because it has to deal with the financial crisis, but it's also dealt with, for example, the Asian financial crisis. We came through that reasonably well. It's also had to deal with kind of the reverse thing, which is what we've been experiencing since, which is the mining boom. We've had really quite some big fluctuations in terms of the shocks hitting the economy. And, you know, we've done reasonably well. So that's kind of one thing we've learned. Now, in contrast, one area where we've started doing a lot more research is on financial markets and banking. And so you can see, you know, financial crisis, shock. And if you look at this kind of more closely, what you actually see is that the questions we're asking are different. It's not because the previous research was wrong in any way. It's just because, obviously, the circumstances you're reacting to are different. And so when the history changes, you start asking different questions, you start learning different things. So to give you a sense of this, once again, some representative titles. In the pre-GFC period, we've got the efficient markets hypothesis, a survey, the effect of macroeconomic conditions on banks' risk and profitability, and identifying the efficacy of central bank interventions, evidence from Australia. You really need snappier titles, don't we? Post-crisis, and this is a sign of maybe something we haven't learnt, we've got some titles like Central Counterparty Links and Clearing System Exposures, a density-based estimator of core periphery network structures, analysing the Australian interbank market, and assessing some models of the impact of financial stress on business cycles. Now, other than we haven't learned to have snappy titles for our research papers, one thing that you might be able to discern in those is that there's been a shift from a kind of macroeconomic perspective and one focused on kind of efficient markets towards analysing the plumbing of markets and the way kind of the structure of markets matters. And this kind of reflects the experience of the financial crisis. The precise network of connections between market participants had a big effect on what was going on. They really affected the functioning of markets. You know, in the US, they discovered suddenly we've got this efficient market and there's one player sitting right at the center of it, and if they go down, we're up. So that's kind of one of the things we've learned, is that the plumbing matters. Financial markets are not, as was occasionally assumed, made up of atomistic individuals with no market power rationally processing perfect information in a frictionless market. Fancy that, yes. They're populated by kind of large players in operating in an environment where getting the right information is really difficult, transactional frictions are large, and there are lots of non-linearities at play. So, you know, these issues weren't unknown prior to the crisis, but the change is perhaps that there's a much deeper realisation that traditionally microeconomic issues don't wash out in the aggregate. They can have big macro consequences. Okay, so the next one we want to talk about is open economy topics. And so, once again, this is one where the focus changed. While the quantity didn't change, the focus did. Earlier papers were concerned with investigating how does monetary policy affect the exchange rate, how does the exchange rate affect monetary policy, and in that respect, it was all part of trying to work out the monetary policy framework. How do we operate in an open economy environment? How should we run the policy? Post-crisis, it changed to be focusing much more on terms of trade. Now, we've had a big mining boom. This had a huge effect on the terms of trade. It really did have a profound effect on the Australian economy. This is an important point about post-GFC in Australia compared to the rest of the world, is our experience was different. We didn't, for example, have to deal with a housing market crash, a sovereign debt crisis, or any of those things. We were in the midst of a mining investment boom. The policy challenges were different, and so what we were researching was different. We weren't studying negative interest rates or quantitative easing. That doesn't mean we weren't learning about that. We were learning from others, but we were focused on different issues in Australia. And one thing that we've learnt in that process is that the adjustment process has been very drawn out. You know, in some senses, you can say the mining investment boom has been over for quite some time, but we are still dealing with the consequences of that and still managing it. And so in that respect, we've kind of learnt something similar, which is these big events can have effects that last for decades. And, you know, the cycles are much longer than they used to be. Now, in one sense, you can say, well, we've had 27 years of uninterrupted growth. You know, that is an unprecedented cycle length. And what this means, however, is that policymaking needs to think a lot further down the road, because when you're talking about we need to think about over the cycle, let's say, that used to be 8 years. Well, now it's at least 27 years, and so you really need to think down the track. But what we're also seeing is that decisions made, you know, 10 years ago are still having effects. Now, I could talk about the other topics, but I want to kind of change the discussion a bit and not look at the questions we were asking, but the answers we were giving and indeed how we were doing it. Because you can get an additional perspective by looking at how we were answering them. And in that respect, there's one change that I want to highlight here, and it's kind of shown up a little bit here. It's the fact that one of the major terms now are things like consumer, behaviour, business. These are all actually much more microeconomic in focus. And this was what I alluded to in the discussion of financial markets, is that in the pre-crisis period, we had a tendency to focus on macroeconomic data. In the post-crisis period, there's a much greater focus on micro data. So you can see this across all the topics. So I've mentioned financial markets, but if you look at, for example, the housing market research, prior to the crisis, there was much more focus, let's say, on aggregate balance sheets. What's the aggregate amount of household debt? Post-crisis, there's much more investigation of individual balance sheets. how much individual households holding, what's the distribution of individual households. And that change from the macro to the micro, you can see that through a lot of research. And I think this is kind of a reflection of a number of mutually reinforcing trends. First and foremost, the financial crisis. It highlighted how individual actions could have profound macroeconomic effects. Moral hazard and asymmetric information. These are primarily microeconomic concerns, but we saw how big a macroeconomic effect they could have as they were transmitted through financial markets. Second, there's kind of been, in the economics profession, an increasing dissatisfaction with the kind of rational expectations, representative agent assumptions that underlie a lot of kind of work. You can see this most clearly in the fact that behavioral economics has come to the forefront. You can see it in the awarding of the Nobel Prize to Kahneman in 2002, to Shiller in 2013, to Richard Thaler in 2017. But it's also present in the way there's kind of more and more frictions being built into models. And these models, so pre-crisis we had new Keynesian models, representative agents. Post-crisis, we've got heterogeneous agent new Keynesian models, which are really taking seriously the fact that there is no one representative household. You actually need to look at the entire range of heterogeneous households in the economy and realize the fact that some of them are liquidity constrained and some of them aren't matters. Indeed, when you're talking about fiscal stimulus, one of the things is that what matters is that you're giving it to a household that's going to spend it rather than put it into the bank. That was one of the concerns that was very much, I think, at the forefront of people's minds when they were thinking about the stimulus. And, you know, knowing that they're going to spend it is really quite important if you want to get that money out and circulating in the economy. The other aspect is there's been an increase in computing power. Basically, computers have become much more powerful, and you can now create, analyze, and access much larger data sets. We're all aware of this in terms of, you know, what's Google and Amazon doing, but it's also true in government. They are basically accumulating databases of data for, you know, running the administrative functions of the government. But what's really going on there is that as this kind of realization that microeconomic data can actually help you answer some really important questions, the government, the ABS, are actually giving more access to these useful databases to researchers to answer some important policy questions. So the RBA has been working with the ABS to do a number of projects. We've had people embedded at the ABS looking at the detailed micro data underlying the wages and the prices data, so we can actually get some really good feeling for what's going on in the economy. For example, talking about fiscal stimulus, there was a paper we put out last year which looked at the individual business investment data to see what effect the GFC investment tax break had. The conclusion was it was very important. It actually had a big effect. This was kind of the small business investment tax credit. It made a difference. And we can see that by looking at every individual business and how they reacted. So, following my proposition that what you do reflects what you've learned, the more micro nature of the research, I think, fundamentally reflects the fact that even at a macro institution like the RBA, we've learned the value of this kind of research. We've learned that micro data can help us answer some big macro questions. So I'd argue that kind of we were having the discussion from Andrew, and he perhaps gave us a different take on Milton Friedman's saying, we're all Keynesians now. I'd say we're all microeconomists now as well. So I've been talking about what's going on at the RBA, but I think it might also be useful to talk about what's been going on in economic research in Australia generally. So to do this, I've basically done the same exercise as I did for the research discussion papers and had a look at what was being published in the Australian Economic Review and the Economic Record. So these are two general interest journals in Australia. And you can see I've put exactly the same topics as I had before. And what you can see is a few interesting differences. First, the quantity of research on monetary policy was actually pretty low. Certainly pre-crisis, there wasn't much. Now, the other thing is, that's as a proportion, but absolutely, it was also low. In the period between 2000 and 2007, there were 22 papers published in the Australian Economic Record and the Economic Review. The RBA published 20. Now, you'd expect us to have a focus on monetary policy, so that's perhaps not too surprising. But I think the thing about this is, while it's natural for us to do specialized research, it's important that we're not the only voice in the room. Without discussion and debate, knowledge is only going to advance slowly. So if we're only talking to ourselves, well, it's going to get very boring after a while. So I think the fact that monetary policy has increased is a good sign. We've got somebody to talk to now. But you know, I think more work there so that we've got more people to talk to would be even better. Another area you can see is that payment systems and banknotes. Sounds rather boring, I guess. But as I said, in the financial crisis, what we learned was that the plumbing matters. So we've done a lot of research on this. And I think it's something that, now, maybe it won't be published in these journals, but this is a sign of perhaps what's of general interest. And I think it should be of more general interest, because the plumbing really does matter. But in the other areas, you'll see there's actually been quite an increase in the research that's being done. The kind of things that we thought were important for understanding the way the economy works have actually started growing a lot in terms of the research interests of the general Australian economics community. So, you know, as was discussed during the financial crisis, there were a lot of late night phone calls and meetings and lots of lack of sleep and kind of bags under the eyes. And what was going on there fundamentally was that people were talking to each other and sharing information. And that's something that is very good to do, not only in the middle of a crisis, but in more normal times. So this increase in the quantity of research on topics that we at the Reserve Bank kind of think is important for understanding the economy in kind of the general economics community is also important for our understanding of the economy that will hopefully stand us in good stead for the next crisis, whatever it might be, or at least for understanding the economy over the next 10 years. So that's kind of my overall talk about kind of what we've learned from the research. I started by suggesting you can tell a lot about what someone has learned by looking at what they do. And if you look at our research, what you can see is that we've learned that flexible inflation targeting actually works pretty well. It's helped us not only over the past 10 years, but over 25 years to have a remarkably resilient economy. We've also learned that the world isn't nearly as efficient as you would like. In financial markets, the connections between participants and how they are actually connected matters for how the market's going to work. We've also learnt that major events can have long-lasting crises. Indeed, there's a growing body of research that shows that events from centuries ago can have an effect. We've got, you know, the colonial origins of growth, which, you know, look at how economies today are affected by events that happened 200 years ago. So the other broad thing that we've learnt is that microeconomics provides some really useful ideas to understand macro. The links between micro and macro are still not very well understood, so we've got a lot more to learn in that area. Now, we're not quite at the end, because I now want to talk about kind of some implications, and I want to talk about what I've learned. And the reason I want to talk about what I've learned is because while I've kind of been trying to do this dispassionately, I do think that if you start thinking about the implications, you can turn your attention to the future. And that's what I really want to do now. I want to think about how our growing understanding of the links between microbehaviour and macrobehaviour affect the way we think about the economy. I also want to be clear that, underline the I a few more times. You know, this is just my view, it's not the view of the Reserve Bank or indeed anyone else at the Reserve Bank. So I want to talk about this from my perspective, and to give you a brief background, I've spent most of my life at the RBA. I started in 1992, just before the adoption of inflation targeting and just after the last recession. Over that period, we've had very stable inflation. I did my PhD on the Great Moderation before it was called the Great Moderation. So, you know, I've been looking at an environment where inflation and output have been very stable. So, what have I learnt? Small things matter. And this is actually quite a big change for me, particularly if you look at kind of my experience of a very stable economy. And it's because, as a macroeconomist, I thought I'd learnt that general equilibrium matters and economic systems have a tendency towards stability and self-correction and things can't get too out of whack. So an analogy from chaos theory, when a butterfly flaps its wings, nothing much happens. But, you know, I've learnt, perhaps. But I want to say kind of the directions I've learnt. And actually, Andrew was touching on this when he was talking about institutions. Because I think that stability that you see in some economies is a reflection of the institutional structure of the economy. So an example of a stabilising institution, perhaps you're not going to be surprised by the example I give, is an independent inflation targeting central bank. So it's got, you know, it's got direct effects because we're actually trying to stabilise the economy, but it also has indirect effects because people expect us to stabilise the economy. And that's really a most powerful channel of our operation, is that because they expect we're going to stabilise the economy, they're going to act on that, and that's going to help us achieve our targets. But I've evolved, and perhaps part of the evolution is because of this realisation that small things matter. And there are two aspects to this. One is that individual biases, individual behavioural quirks, they don't wash out at the aggregate level. I think we saw that very much in the financial crisis. And perhaps the second one from the behavioural economics literature is that there's an awful lot of behavioural biases we're all affected by. This includes me, so I'm not kind of speaking as if I'm not affected by them. And, you know, we learned how an individual, just making an individually rational, or at least making a decision they thought was good to buy a house in Nevada, could snowball through the financial system and ultimately lead to the global financial crisis. We saw how moral hazard and asymmetric information could essentially shut down financial markets at the core of the global financial system. And today we see risk-on and risk-off cycles, which I think are best understood as essentially herding and behavioural biases among financial market participants. So, you know, this is perhaps not a learning, but the implications, maybe there's something new in that. And it was my comment about institutions being stabilising. And I don't think that this inherent stability can happen by accident. I think you actually need to think about this. And I think we need to think about this a lot more than we have in the past. You need to make some big decisions about the design of institutions and systems to take account of the fact that everybody, including the regulators, are affected by behavioural biases. You know, we can take these learnings fully to heart, and you really need to change things. One of the examples, perhaps, would be in financial product regulation. We used to have a philosophy that disclosure is enough. You tell people the information, and then they can make informed and rational decisions about what's right for them. I think the fact that even highly informed financial market participants bought products that they fundamentally didn't understand in the middle of the crisis shows you that disclosure isn't enough. These insights from behavioural economics also apply to institutional culture. There's a much greater appreciation now. I mean, you hear the word quite a lot, you know, institutional culture. It really matters. And institutional culture is an accumulation of individual behavioural biases. Why is it that culture is so powerful at the end of the day is because we all kind of go along with that individually. It's not that there's anything wrong with that. That's what it is human to do. But recognising that, you need to build that into the way you design institutions. You need to take account of human psychology and cultural incentives and design around that. So, in conclusion, and I mean it, I think there's been a lot learnt since the financial crisis, and the most important, I think, is that small things matter. Individual behaviour doesn't necessarily average out, and the true test of whether we've learnt this is whether we change our behaviour as a result. And I think in that respect, with respect to regulations and institutions, corporate and government, kind of really thinking through these issues is an important and ongoing need. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John. Now, because this session is being recorded, I would ask you to use the microphone when you ask a question. So.
Hi, John. Philip Williams. Thanks very much for that very informative talk. If we have a look back at the GFC, and particularly the prior speaker basically saying how the world handled that, I would suggest that that was a failure of central banking, in that if central banking is responsible for financial stability, then if they had been doing what they were doing, we should have never had a global financial crisis. You've also talked about the fact that we've learnt now and macroeconomic, in our understanding of macroeconomic theory has changed quite dramatically, which would indicate to me that we didn't have a good understanding of how the economy worked before, and I question whether we have a good understanding of how it works now. So the question I would ask now is, what do we not know about the next financial crisis?
You've got 2 minutes.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it would be the height of hubris to say we understand everything about the world. I think we know more now than we did in the past. And I think kind of the process, at least, of crisis management was, you know, Ben Bernanke had studied the Great Depression. And the thing he learned from that is what not to do. And as a consequence, I think the global economy and also, you know, Keynesianism, he'd learned from the Great Depression as well. And the reaction to this crisis meant that we didn't have nearly the kind of results we had back then, because that was kind of the prior crisis that was similar in scale. So we have learned something, and indeed that was applied during the crisis. Whether things are perfect now, no, I wouldn't claim that things are perfect now. But we certainly know better. And you'll see that institutions are being redesigned. You'll see that through the Basel process. And we have, kind of looking across the world, we can see that some countries handled it better than others. Australia actually did remarkably well. And I think that is a reflection of the institutions we have here compared with the kind of institutions you have in other countries. With any luck, those institutions can change, but that's actually a hard process. So, you know, what don't we know yet? If I knew that... But we can keep pushing on that and keep trying to learn. And at least, you know, a sign of learning is at least that we don't repeat the mistakes of the past. There are many more mistakes we can make in the future, I'm sure.
This question over here, I believe, yes.
Could I just, as background, at the beginning of 2010, I started running a class in macroeconomics at the University of the Third Age in Brisbane, because I thought that it would be very interesting to observe the follow-up from the GFC. And so I've been running that class now for 9 years. And therefore I've been studying macroeconomics for 9 years. And the one thing that's really sort of leaped out at me in that time is that the biggest single driver of economic behaviour seems to be expectations. And Andrew referred to the psychological importance of whether we had a second recession or not. And I wondered whether it's commonly felt that expectations is as important as I think they are.
So certainly inflation expectations play a big role in the way we think about how monetary policy operates. The harder thing is thinking about whether you can change those expectations by words or you need to change them by actions. I think, as I said, there's a lot more to be learnt about how expectations are formed. We know that kind of rational expectations is not a perfect model of what's going on, but the alternatives, unfortunately, are huge. You can kind of come up with a huge number of ways of thinking about it, and we need to kind of go through all that. I mean, this was essentially the work of Kahneman, was they were just doing a bunch of individual experiments, just looking at, you know, here's one way people behave at odds with kind of perfect rational expectations. And here's another one, and here's another one, and here's another one. So expectations are certainly important, but what we don't yet know is really how they're formed. How and then what do you do that affects them? You know, is it sufficient for the central bank to say, we think inflation is going to be X, or does it require us to be moving interest rates around for that to happen? There's more work to be done.
Yes. Did the focus on atomistic individuals with no market power become more or less important during the GFC, and why? Did the focus on atomistic individuals with no market power become more important or less important during the GFC, and why?
Can you paraphrase the question?
I mean, the question is essentially, was this understanding of the way the markets work, which was kind of, you know, this kind of efficient markets, if you will, version where you've got, you know, small individuals with no power, did it become more or less important? I think the events of the financial crisis made it irrelevant in the sense that people were dealing with, you know, very big players, they were dealing with very big markets and the fact that those markets weren't working. So whether or not there were, you know, they weren't important. We were understanding that we need to understand that these big players matter and that the markets were not efficient. So I'd say less important.
Other questions?
Hi, an earlier paper of yours was about generation rent, and remember that?
Yep.
So will that phenomenon fit as, I don't know, one of your components to what's coming up?
So to give a relative
change.
Yeah, well, so a summary of that work was essentially looking at what is it that is affecting first home buyer preferences? Why are there fewer first home buyers out there? What's going on? Now, one thing I learned from that actually was that you don't actually have to rely on hard and fast rules about who can have a loan and who can't have a loan. People are actually making choices for themselves. They may not be perfect, but you know, the prospect of taking on huge load of debt is a constraint in itself. And what you notice is that a lot of people, so recently we found that only 10% of people are borrowing up to the maximum that the bank would lend them. And I think that is kind of one of the things that we need to understand about human psychology is you can understand that people will be self-limiting. People, not everybody is going to go out and borrow irrationally and borrow the maximum they can because they are thinking ahead. And so in this generation rent paper, one thing we saw was that essentially there is this filtering device going on because in order to get a first home today, you need to save up quite a large deposit. The ability to save up that deposit is actually a very good filter in terms of demonstrating that you're an individual who can think about the future, who can put money away, who can kind of budget, rather than imagining that the only way we can prevent people from taking on unsustainable levels of debt is to put in rules that kind of tightly prescribe what's going on. You've got both going on, and I think kind of in terms of, what are we thinking about for institutions for the future, you need to recognise that both of these forces are going on. You've got rules that are going to limit some excesses, because there are always going to be people who are going to try and borrow to the limit, but you also need to recognise that the behaviour of people is going to take some of that into account. And if you can understand how they're going to behave, you'll be able to set rules much better, which means that people who actually can afford and kind of will be able to pay back because they have, the discipline to save up a deposit, they should be able to get a loan, provided they've got that quality and it's designing an institution in such a way that you can actually identify those people.
We have one more question.
Yes, while I'm no academic when it comes to economics, I understand the role of the RBA is monetary policy, and you mentioned levers that you have at your disposal. My understanding is that the only lever you have is interest rates, but I have heard on the radio a discussion along the lines of quantitative easing. Now, are we there yet?
No, because we're at 1.5%. I think a few years ago we certainly explored the possibilities, and as has been demonstrated in other economies, you have at least two options, but there are many. And I think the other thing that I want to emphasise, yes, quantitative easing is one of them, but monetary policy is one arm of government policy. Fiscal policy is another one. And so the discussion of the financial crisis highlights that monetary policy is not the only game in town. You actually have quite a few arms of policy. Actually, it's going to be a bit like Shiva, I think, because not only do you have fiscal and monetary policy, but you've got prudential policy. And a lot of the action since the financial crisis, there's been the monetary policy, but there's also been the prudential policy and thinking about how do we actually operate the financial stability framework. So, it's not a case of we need to do everything as the central bank. We've got more tools than we thought we did, but generally speaking, if all the arms of government are working together, you're going to get a much better outcome than if everybody's operating independently.
Quick question?
Yeah, just a quick one. I note, of course, that you have some competition in the Reserve Bank. With the Big Four banks seem to be setting their own monetary interest rate policy. So.
So they are setting interest rates responding to what's going on in the market. Despite what you may have heard, one of the big things going on in the market is what's the rate they can borrow overnight from us. So while it may not be one for one as it was in the past, it's still a big influence on what's going on. And at the end of the day, we can change interest rates in such a way that it has the effect we need on the economy. And indeed, that's one of the things about monetary policy is it's not a kind of a one-shot deal. We don't get to make a decision and then we have to wait a few years and then we get to make another decision. The board meets every month and they can keep looking at what's going on. And to the extent that the effect may not be exactly what you want, you can change and you can keep updating. So I don't think that's a significant concern.
We need to draw it to a close. But thank you so much, John, for that very good address.